This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates that relate to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wild lands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Eric Mulvar. He's Executive Director of the Western Watersheds Project, a nonprofit conservation group dedicated to protecting and restoring wildlife and watersheds throughout the American West. Eric is a wildlife biologist with scientific research in behavioral ecology and systems ecology of moose, and has spent 10 years as an author of guidebooks to national parks and wilderness areas, including one about Wyoming's Red Desert. He's been a conservation professional for 21 years, working first in the Bureau of Land Management Wilderness Inventory and later on oil and gas issues, sage-grouse conservation, large carnivore defense, land use planning, and livestock issues.
So, Eric, since we talked last, what have been the primary projects that Western Watersheds has been working on?
WWFP has been working on livestock grazing reform throughout the American West, and we had a lawsuit that we pursued to try and get some prioritization of grazing allotment environmental assessments, which was somewhat successful. And also, we have been working on reforming livestock grazing on Point Reyes National Seashore in California, which had just reached a settlement where 12 of the 14 livestock operations will be bought out and will leave the seashore.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a great story. I thought they were going to be continuing to operate.
Well, they were under the old 2020 plan, but we filed a lawsuit against that and were able to broker a settlement. And that settlement also allows tule elk to have free roam around the Point Reyes National Seashore. So they're no longer going to be bottled up on that sometimes waterless and forage-poor peninsula behind the elk fence.
I heard they were going to build, they were going to replace the old fence with a new fence that allowed the elk to exit out of the northern part of the peninsula, but prohibited cattle from moving into the elk area.
That was their original plan when it was announced, but that was prior to the settlement. It'll be interesting to see whether they bother with the elk permeable fence now that there isn't going to be a livestock operation adjacent to the Tomales Point Elk Reserve.
Holy smokes. Well, that's fascinating knowledge. I don't even think you knew that a month ago, did you? Is that even
the settlement just happened last week.
You're right, yeah. Holy smokes. Well, that's
Also, you know, we've been working a lot on trying to protect wolves under the Endangered Species Act, both defending against the Trump wolf delisting, and disappointingly the Biden administration decided to try and appeal the win that we had that relisted wolves nationwide. And so we're defending that victory. And then we petitioned wolves for relisting in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming.
Okay.
And that petition was denied by the Biden administration.
So
we are litigating that. And we are trying to get them onto the endangered species list so that they can get protection against the aggressive and bloodthirsty policies of those three states.
So what kind of obstacles do you have to overcome to get that with the hostile Trump administration coming in?
We don't have any illusions that the Trump administration is going to voluntarily list wolves under the Endangered Species Act and give them protection.
Right.
So they're going to have to be sued into submission, and we're taking the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to court, and the Trump administration is going to inherit that lawsuit, and we hope to beat the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in court and have the court instruct them to go ahead and relist those wolves. So there's that.
Uh-huh.
And we've also been quite engaged in advocacy to prevent the delisting of grizzly bears in the Northern Rockies, both in Yellowstone and also in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem, which is primarily Glacier National Park and the Bob Marshall Wilderness.
Right.
And that was met with some qualified success because the agency decided not to delist the bears, but did restrict their range of protection within a distinct population area, which is less than their historic range.
Right, those five areas that are designated?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's less than their previous protection before they rolled out this rule. And then they're talking about bringing out a 4D special rule under that listing that we're concerned might add even more loopholes to ESA protection for grizzly bears.
Uh-huh.
And so that's bad news, and we're going to have to continue to fight on that front.
Yeah, all right. I just was checking earlier today about the presence of grizzlies in the Bitterroot. One person had challenged me about when I said that they were absent from the Bitterroot. Well, I guess they're not absent, but they're only occasionally seen, but they aren't any permanent habitat. Is that right? Is that your knowledge?
That's true. There have been some grizzly bears that have made it across the valley and into the Bitterroots and into the Selway Clearwater watersheds over in Idaho, but they haven't been numerous enough to establish a breeding population.
Right.
And the Montana Game and Fish Department is doing everything it can to prevent grizzlies from reestablishing themselves in that important core habitat, which is really kind of critical to connect the grizzly bears in the northern continental divide of Glacier and the Bob Marshall with the Yellowstone grizzly bears.
Right.
So, ironically, the state of Montana is shooting the state of Wyoming in the foot by preventing grizzly bears from reconnecting through that Selway Bitterroot core area.
Uh-huh.
And by keeping that Yellowstone grizzly population isolated, that means that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is not legally able to remove protections from the Yellowstone bears.
Great. So do you operate primarily in any particular state or area, or is your focus pretty generalized throughout the West?
Western Watersheds Project works on western public lands all the way from the Rocky Mountain front westward to the Pacific Ocean. And we have state directors that cover every western state. So we have offices scattered throughout the West. We are active out there in the field monitoring public lands all over the West. And we have lawsuits going in a variety of different states at any given time.
And where are you located?
I am currently located in the Santa Ynez Valley of California, although WWP's headquarters is in Haley, Idaho.
Oh, yeah. That's what I thought, yeah. Okay, so what are you doing down in the Santa Ynez?
Well, I just relocated here, but I'm still running the organization remotely from the Santa Ynez Valley, just as I did from Laramie, Wyoming, for 8 years before that. So the view outside the window has changed, and nothing else has changed about my job.
You're not burning up, huh? No fires near you?
No fires yet. Knock on wood.
Yeah. All right. So let's get to the election. Has the result revised what you're concentrating on at all?
Certainly Western Watersheds Project is gearing up for a Trump administration that we expect to launch some attacks on public lands and on wildlife and on federal regulations protecting them. So last Trump administration, President Trump appointed a number of industry representatives to head government agencies, and we had a running battle throughout those 4 years, and we were pretty successful in preventing the Trump administration, the first go-round, from getting much done to undermine public lands and wildlife. When the Trump administration gutted Bears Ears and Grand Staircase National Monuments and cut them in size, we were able to join seven other organizations and file lawsuits, and eventually we were able to beat back that attack, and the Biden administration did restore those monuments. When the Trump administration tried to delist Yellowstone grizzlies, we met them in court, and along with five other groups of plaintiffs, we were able to defeat them, and the judge relisted grizzlies and put them back under federal protection blocking trophy hunting. When the Trump administration delisted wolves nationwide and opening them up to trophy hunting in different states, WWP and our allies took them to court, and we were victorious, and the wolves were placed back on the endangered species list. So in addition, there were a number of smaller victories. In Wyoming, we had a 5,000 oil and gas project that we were able to stop that was approved under Trump, and also the Thunder Basin National Grassland Prairie Dog Plan, which was going to increase prairie dog poisoning and shooting, and delete the black-footed ferret reintroduction area on the Thunder Basin, was reversed by federal courts thanks to a lawsuit brought by WWP and argued by our in-house staff attorneys.
Will you have to fight those battles again with the new administration?
Well, we'll see. You know, maybe they've learned that they don't want to mess with the public lands and wildlife, or maybe they want to go another round with us and we're ready to knock them out again.
So Doug Burgum is going to be the new Interior Secretary. What do you expect he'll focus on?
Based on the news reports leading up to his nomination, I would expect that he would be focusing primarily on increasing oil and gas production and maybe coal production. So those are the main focuses that that have been made public in the announcements of his environmental priorities. But we'll have to wait and see.
Well, I just heard that the effort to do oil and gas drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that has been set aside. So I'm wondering if the administration is going to have trouble with their drilling objectives.
It does seem like every time there's a Republican administration over the last 20 or 30 years, they try to open up the Arctic Refuge to oil and gas drilling and punch drilling rigs into that calving ground for the porcupine caribou herd, which would be an environmental disaster. They don't need to do that. One thing that we learned from Prudhoe Bay and all the oil and gas development on that part of the North Slope is that even though there are some bull caribou that might still wander around the oil fields, the actual pregnant females are displaced from the oil and gas drilling activity, and they're pushed up into the foothills where they're more susceptible to predators.
Yeah.
And that's an unnatural situation that's created by the human activity that we don't need to repeat in the Arctic Refuge.
But aren't they having trouble with oil drilling in other locations as well?
Well, certainly up there in Alaska, the Biden administration approved the Willow drilling project on the North Slope, much to the shock and dismay of a lot of environmentally minded Americans, and that was a mistake. I don't know why they decided to do that, but they did, and so that allows fossil fuel development to move forward in that part of the sensitive Arctic.
So, what else do you think that Doug Burgum has in mind in Department of Interior?
Well, like I say, we're going to be monitoring the situation and see what rolls out in terms of proposals. But one of the things that under Project 2025 and the Trump administration's transition team announcements seems to be a priority is to try and undo and revoke anything that the Biden administration has done.
Right. So and what about the
part of the kind of ping pong game match that happens as administrations change? I remember when I was a younger person, it used to be that the new administration would kind of respect the decisions of the previous presidency and let them stand. But nowadays, each new presidential administration, the tradition seems now to be to try and reverse everything that the predecessor has done, and that's particularly a strong tendency amongst Republican presidents.
Well, Biden just announced two new national monuments in California a couple days ago.
That's right. That's Chuckwalla and Satitla.
Right.
And WWP was lobbying pretty hard for that Satitla National Monument on the Modoc Plateau in Northern California. And we're also glad to see the Chuckwalla Monument down in the Mojave Desert, although that's an area that has already been cleared off from livestock grazing, so it's in pretty good ecological shape. But it does mean that we won't see industrial-scale renewable projects, we hope, in that national monument.
Well, Trump, for his first administration, he narrowed the boundaries of the Bears Ear and also the Escalante National Monuments, but he didn't cancel them. So what do you think his powers or his attempt to affect those monuments could be?
Well, the opponents of monument designation in southern Utah have always argued that those monuments are very large and are too big to accommodate the objects for which the monuments were designated.
Right.
But that kind of argument is a pretty weak argument, because if you look at Bears Ears, that was a national monument that was really set aside primarily to protect the cliff dwellings and the rock art and other indigenous ancestral sites that really litter that area. I mean, you can hardly walk half a mile without running into either a rock art panel or a cliff dwelling of some kind or an old granary from those Paleo-Indian settlements. And so the idea that you can shrink the monument, when Trump shrunk the monument the first time, he left out a whole bunch of major cliff dwellings that for which the monument was designated.
Right.
Similarly, Grand Staircase Escalante was designated for the geological resources that it holds, and particularly the staircase of sedimentary strata that go all the way down from the Clarion Formation at the very top all the way down to the Grand Canyon. These big sedimentary cliffs that kind of unveil older and older and older strata of geologic time that have fossil resources in them. There is not one square inch of the National Monument as it currently stands that's not underlain by one of those stair steps. So the argument that you can shrink the monument because it's bigger than it needs to be for those monument objects seems pretty arbitrary and silly to me.
So Brooke Rollins is going to take over at the Secretary of Agriculture, and what does that mean for the Forest Service?
You know, it's really hard to say, but the Forest Service is curiously a lot more insulated than we see, say, from the Bureau of Land Management. And the chief of the Forest Service is not a political appointee. He does typically get hired in as a new chief of the Forest Service, but from the ranks of the career professionals that are working in the Forest Service agency. So it's not like the Trump administration is going to be able to hand-pick some timber lobbyist to plunk down to be the chief of the Forest Service. It's just not, you know, structurally able to be done. Although we will see political appointees in the Department of Agriculture overseeing the Forest Service, and we may indeed see lobbyists from the oil industry or the timber industry appointed into some of those positions. And they're going to be doing their level best to try and make the Forest Service run according to maximizing industrial outputs to the detriment of public recreation, of wildlife, of healthy forest ecosystems. So it's something that is certainly a concern.
So the election map showed quite a shift in the districts that voted for Trump and for the House and Senate seats in the West. And rural America shows solidly behind Trump despite his past behavior and the policies that you oppose. So what's your feeling about rural America and how it's going to endure the next 4 years and how it possibly could be changed and approached differently than it has been in the past?
Well, you know, when you talk about rural America, you're not talking about a monolithic political group of people. It's everything from some really extreme right-wing and maybe even neo-fascist groups like the Bundy crowd, all the way over to some extremely progressive communities on the West Slope of Colorado and other parts of the West. And you, across the board, when you poll Western communities, including rural areas, you find a strong and growing support for conservation and environmental priorities, for having healthy public lands, for having abundant wildlife, for having good recreation opportunities that support the quality of life. The economies in these regions really are shifting away from the older extraction-based industries toward more tech and service sector and tourism economies. And so even as the old politics of the West seems alive and well, the demographic shift and the economic shift of the West is steadily moving away from the timber, grazing, and mining sectors of the economy and toward sectors of the economy that really value healthy lands and beautiful places. And so that's good news for the environment over the long term.
And that's the change you're trying to take effect to provide better education and better embrace of environmental policies for farmers and ranchers and other people in the rural parts of America.
That's certainly true, and we are also simultaneously trying to educate the public on a constant basis about the realities of the threats that are facing our public lands, the species that are declining, the false statements sometimes of industries that are trying to point the finger of blame away from their own operations so that they can't be held accountable for the damage that they're doing to public lands. Mm-hmm. We're the truth squad. And so our public relations efforts focus around getting science into the public debate so that we can have better informed political leaders, better informed agency officials, and more accountability toward the laws that are there to protect our environment.
There's a recent article in High Country News about prairie dogs and how, I guess, there are some ranchers who are beginning to accommodate to the value that prairie dogs provide to their property.
Certainly, the livestock industry's war against prairie dogs has always been myopic and misguided. It's been a bad idea from the very start.
Uh-huh.
And it really has had a major destructive effect on grassland ecosystems, particularly out on the Great Plains. Prairie dogs are a keystone species, and they support a variety of very rare wildlife, everything from swift foxes and burrowing owls to mountain plovers and black-footed ferrets. Prairie dogs are one of those species that are kind of considered the burritos, the frozen burritos of the plains. Everybody eats them. That's a carnivore. So they're really an important part of the ecosystem. So when ranchers go and poison all of the prairie dog colonies and wipe out this species, they're also wiping out dozens of other types of wildlife that depend on them.
Mm. You wrote an article some time ago titled Cows, Carbon, and Climate Change. What was your thesis in that article?
Well, one of the main problems that's gotten a lot of attention in terms of the impact of cattle on climate change is emissions of methane. And methane is a gas that is 85 times as potent as carbon dioxide in terms of the global warming impact. And because cattle and sheep are ruminants, meaning they have four-chambered stomachs, their first chambered stomach is the rumen, which has a fermentation vat, and that fermentation vat basically produces swamp gas as a byproduct. And that means that swamp gas, when it's burped out or farted out by the cattle, rises up into the atmosphere, becomes part of that global warming blanket that prevents the heat from escaping the atmosphere, and it cooks the climate. And then you get the superstorms and the large-sized fires and the, you know, hurricanes of unusual size and duration and all the other disasters that are costing the taxpayer so many millions of dollars and causing so much loss of life and property. So, you know, that is the focus of the climate experts up to this point has been primarily on the emissions of cattle, kind of an end-of-tailpipe kind of analysis, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And in that analysis, there's a new study that came out a couple of years ago out of Oregon State University that shows that cattle grazing on public lands creates even greater methane emissions than cattle on feedlots because those cattle on public lands are eating much lower quality forage out there on the desert than they are when they're being fed a corn diet on a feedlot. So the lower quality diet means more swamp gas production, more methane burps, more climate change. But then also, another major part of the equation is the damage that the cattle are doing to the land's ability to store carbon. And make no mistake about it, the level of carbon or the level of cattle grazing in the western United States is so heavy that it is destroying the native perennial bunch grasses, those long-living, deep-rooted, carbon-sequestering native plants that are original to this area and should be the indicators of healthy lands. And what's replacing those when the cattle go in and destroy them is non-native invasive annual grasses like cheatgrass and Medusa Head wild rye. And these kinds of weeds grow for maybe 6 weeks in the spring, die, dry out, and become tinder dry and fuel massive rangeland fires.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, the livestock industry is trying to pull the wool over the public's eyes and blame wildfires themselves for the expansion of cheatgrass.
Mm-hmm.
But we have seen that in areas that don't have any cattle grazing, like the Idaho National Laboratory, where they do atomic testing in central Idaho, those areas burn and they come back in native perennial bunch grasses. Cheatgrass can't get a foothold when you have healthy native bunch grasses on the ground. It takes cattle to wipe out those native bunch grasses and give the cheatgrass a beachhead to get established and start spreading.
Well, Eric, we've run out of time, but I have a lot more questions, so in our next session, I'll pose those to you, if that's okay. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our guest today has been Eric Melvar, Executive Director of the Western Watersheds Project, a nonprofit conservation group dedicated to protecting and restoring wildlife and watersheds throughout the American West. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. If you'd like to know more about GWA, go to its website at gallatinwildlife.org and see what is being done to conserve America's wildlife. To hear more of these half-hour presentations and interviews, go online to kgvm.org and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife, where you'll see a large number of interviews from which to choose. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.